Brethren, again, the premise of the wisdom of the Proverbs, Proverbs 9 at verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. I want to direct your attention to another passage that Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 8 at verses 12 and 13 that I hope expand our understanding of this premise. Solomon writes, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear Him openly, as the NAS translates. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow, because he does not fear God. Well, I direct your attention back to that statement. Those who fear God, who fear Him openly, the underlying language reads literally, before Him, and seems to convey that the God-fearer lives with a felt sense of God's eye upon him, a consciousness of the presence and the omniscience of God. The God-fearer fears sincerely, truly and really, because he lives with a consciousness, a keen sense of the presence of God, comprehending all he does, thinks, and says. That presence is expressed in these ways, going back to Proverbs chapter 5, verse 21. The ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. I think that's the equivalent to the expression in Ecclesiastes 8. Again in Proverbs, at chapter 15, verse 3. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the evil and the good. Again, I believe that is nearly synonymous with what Solomon would later write in Ecclesiastes 8. Jeremiah writes in chapter 16, verse 17 of his prophecy, my eyes are on all their ways. They are not hidden from my face, nor is their iniquity concealed from my eyes. The God-fearer lives with his pervasive, governing consciousness of God that includes this consciousness of living under the eye of God. God is present when one clicks on the internet. Notwithstanding the sense of privacy and the remoteness of discovery, God is present. When you click on the internet, for good or for evil, you're doing it under the eye of God. when the crowd, young people, entices you to evil, while your parents may not be there, your response under that enticement is under the eye of God. It's literally before Him. J.I. Packer writes, "Living becomes an awesome business when you realize that you spend every moment of your life in the sight and company of an omniscient, omnipresent Creator." I add, that is, when you realize you live before Him. Such a sense is a feature, an aspect, a dimension of the fear of God. Well, brethren, tonight we are going to consider Ephesians chapter 6 at verse 4. I know it was touched on a week ago tonight. We're also going to consider Colossians 3 at verse 21. Now, if you're trying to follow this in my archaic outline, we'll be dealing with these three pages. The heading of the first of the three, and this is under that section, Roman numeral 2, significant text. Ephesians 6:4 and Colossians 3:21 that goes on for two pages, and then there's this highly sophisticated chart that follows. It's actually a helpful chart, but it's not too sophisticated. It's pretty dinosaur-like. Ephesians 6:4 and Colossians 3:21. Perhaps it could not be said that anything approaching a complete consideration of parenthood, that it could be considered complete without dealing with these texts. They are primary texts that we find in Paul's letters. Now we're going to begin tonight by doing the work, a little bit of work of interpretation, noting that in each of the two, the address is fathers. Ephesians 6:4 and fathers. Colossians 3:21, fathers. And the question is, why? Why does Paul lay upon the shoulders of fathers the primary responsibility of the rearing of their children? Well, we can answer that question negatively and quickly in this way. Looking at the Ephesian passage, it's not because he had forgotten the word for parents. Look back at Ephesians 6 at verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. He had not forgotten, had not had temporary amnesia, causing the word parents to escape his memory. Going to Colossians 3 at verse 20. Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. So fathers are addressed not because of a forgetfulness concerning the word parents. Again, not because he'd forgotten the word for mothers. Noting in Ephesians 6 at verse 2, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise. We can also add, Paul is not conveying by this address, surely, that mothers do not play a critical role. the very book, the book of Proverbs, would overthrow that kind of thinking. Rather, Paul deliberately and purposefully names fathers in these two parallel texts in Colossians and Ephesians because they are primarily accountable for, responsible for the task that follow. Now that doesn't comport with post-World War II America. Post-World War II America, this kind of thinking, perhaps we could say, sounds radical. For the typical home has been occupied, it seems, by a father whose idea has been that his part is to earn a livelihood and pay the bills. And virtually everything else is sloughed off on the mother. The wife and mother is responsible for the job of rearing the children. Dad goes to work, brings home a paycheck, and mother attends to the details of rearing the children. Ephesians 6:4 and Colossians 3:21 expressly say, in contrast to what our culture may well be saying, that fathers are the primary accountable agents for the training of their children. And such a view was so embedded in the thinking of the apostle that when he described his pastoral labor among the Thessalonians, he likens it to a father with his children. Chapter 2 at verse 11, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you just as a father would his own children. Is that the picture of the average American father? I doubt it. Again, why fathers? Fathers have been designated by God as head of the household. Fathers, the address is not intended to tell mothers that they can ignore these parental instructions. They stand under the canopy of their husband's headship. Fathers administer great amounts of instruction and discipline, formative instruction and corrective discipline by delegation to the mother. Yet, at the end of the day, God holds dad finally responsible for the child's upbringing. Another answer to the question, why this address? Why fathers? Well, what we're going to see under the prohibitions, not to provoke to anger, not to exasperate, may infer that fathers are the ones who have a strong tendency to do just that. A strong tendency to drive children to anger and to take the wind out of their sails. Mothers seem to have an extraordinary amount of patience and forbearance with their children. Fathers, generally speaking, have much less than mothers. And as the mother is more prone to the indulgent fondness, which allows a child to go his own way, so the father is more prone to an angry impatience and an angry impulsiveness, which when vented and vented chronically drives a child to an angry exasperation. In other words, fathers have a decided bent to provoke children to anger to exasperate and to break their spirits. The language is in Colossians 3:21 that they not lose heart. Further, as to this address, fathers have a strong bent to neglect the responsibilities that God has given. Going back to earlier comments, to shove off these duties upon wife and mother, he may neglect them by default. He becomes so involved in other things, work, hobbies, adult toys, personal interests, that he has no time, no energy for his children. He rarely sees them. He's seldom at home. And when he is, he's too tired, he's too occupied with other things. He thinks he's had enough pressure and problem at work and thus refuses to get involved. Well, enough about the address. Fathers, Ephesians 6:4, do not provoke your children to anger. Colossians 3:21, do not exasperate, as the NAS renders, your children. Well, we want to look at these two prohibitions. First, Ephesians 6:4, do not provoke to anger. Translating a single Greek verb, which means, as it's evident by the English rendering, to rouse one to anger, to drive one to a wrathful, irritated attitude or disposition. The picture is of a child with what we might say is a normal fallen tendency to anger that's possessed by any sinner. But by means of certain provocations, certain behaviors of the father, the child is driven to a settled disposition of anger. The child at length has a personality shaped and formed that is prominently marked by anger. And then the Colossians 3:21 text, do not exasperate. This comes from a different Greek verb. It seems to be really synonymous with the Ephesians 6:4 verb. It can be expressed in the English of stirring up, exciting, stimulating to, aggravating. And if there is a distinction between what I'm going to call synonyms, though two different verbs, maybe the distinction is this. The Ephesians 6:4 verb is pointing to the ends of the provocation. That is the result, the end being, in the child, the formation of this settled, brooding sense of anger, wrought by the chronic provocations of the dad. The Colossians 3:21 text, possibly its emphasis, if there is a distinction, placed upon the means of getting to that. Putting the two synonyms or complementary verbs together, the apostolic warning is to be on guard with regard to your words and your conduct and your attitudes and your negligence, your provocations that drive your son or a daughter to a settled attitude of resentment and bitterness and anger and exasperation. Do not mar your child's personality, your child's disposition. Do not mar it with that deep, brooding, settled anger towards life. And more than that, more targeted towards you. The Colossians 3:21 text continues. Paul continues his warning there with the words that they may not lose heart. The underlying Greek simply means, pretty much like the English makes plain, it's the idea of giving up, quitting, becoming discouraged. To say it differently, dispirited, dejected, downcast. We speak of taking the wind out of a boat's sails. Well, that's a metaphor for this language. The sails collapse. The boat stays, but the sails collapse. That's a metaphorical picture for this language. We speak of letting the air out of a balloon. Again, a metaphorical expression for this language. Paul is warning fathers that they must be on their guard so as not to irritate and provoke their children unto an angry disposition that so finally result and the child losing heart, becoming utterly discouraged, quitting on you, and maybe just quitting on life itself. The child reaches a point, Paul is warning, where he or she concludes that the satisfaction of my parents is impossible. And they angrily throw in the towel. The wind has been taken out of the child's sails by way of constant aggravation and exasperation experienced here at the hands of dad. They conclude, there's nothing I can do to please him. J. Adams, in his old book, Christian Living in the Home, Chapter 8, Discipline with Dignity. It may be an old book. It is worth reading. He says, and I quote, "Exasperating children is a precise description of what happens so often in our day. Angry exasperation most clearly describes the prevalent attitude of rebellion among so many young people. No two words could better describe the contemporary attitude than anger mixed with exasperation. Youth have been losing heart with, giving up on, and writing off their parents' discipline in disgust." Close quote. The picture is that of young people who have turned their backs on and closed their ears, closed their minds to parental authority and quite possibly all other authority. I would offer they're connected. And thus, in their disheartened state, they give themselves over to every kind of self-destructive gratification as they pursue their own desires and their own pleasures, giving themselves over to chemicals and alcohol and immorality, giving up on a decent appearance, becoming reclusive, verbally unresponsive, silent, withdrawn. And brethren, now we ask at this point the question of an applicatory nature. And the question is, what parental behaviors provoke a child to anger, to exasperation, to the point the child just writes you off, gives up. Well, I'm going to suggest several, and your outline has room to jot them down if you choose. I want to say, giving credit where credit is due, look at the bibliography. Here's one, as we begin, the answer to the question. These, obviously, I don't have chapter and verse, they're suggested possibilities. I think they make sense, but you be the judge of that. Unannounced rules that are made known only after the child has violated them, and in consequence of that violation of an unannounced rule, the child is punished. Now, to explain the sense of that, I asked the chief, what's the speed limit out here on I-5? I thought I remembered 60, and that was correct. Now, suppose tomorrow you or I are driving down I-5, and we're going 60, and a trooper pulls in behind us, and it's very clear he wants us on the shoulder. We pull over, and he walks up to our vehicle, tells us we had broken the law, and explains to us that last week the legislature reduced the limit to 50 on I-5, but they haven't had time to post it. But you violated it. How would you feel? Probably pretty aggravated inside. You may not say it in the moment, but there would be a sense, this is unjust. Well, the point is, your child will feel the same way on those occasions when he is punished for violating standards that have been unannounced, poorly, if explained at all. Perhaps your child wanders out of the yard and down the street, and you explode in a tirade of anger. But the reality is, you never issued a warning. You never issued instruction. Perhaps the child arrives home at hours later than you prefer, and you react, but you've never told that son or daughter what time to be home. Or maybe you instructed your son or daughter to go upstairs and clean the room. You enter the room sometime later, find the bed unmade and several drawers halfway out, and you erupt inside and then administer corporeal punishment, and you never had instructed that child of what clean your room means. We begin there. Unannounced standards. If you are subject to those at work or somewhere else, well, just draw a line between your response there in that venue and your son or daughter in your home. You do that for long, and your child is on the road to that subtle sense of anger and giving up on you. How can I please my father or mother if I don't even know what the standards are? Here's another one, inconsistency. Children need a measure of predictability. They need to know the limits and have the limits consistently enforced. Regrettably, that predictability and consistency may not be found in their fathers or mothers. For many children, the rules change day by day. The stated rules were enforced one day and not the next. Enforcement, quite sadly, is not related to principle, but to a variety of things in the parent, the mood of the parent, convenience on the parent's part, laziness. Some years ago in this connection, I viewed a film that illustrated this matter of inconsistency. The essence was this. A dad has had a tense day at work, a fatiguing day at work. He arrives home from work, walks up the sidewalk, trips over his son's bicycle. Angered, he rushes into the house, yells at the son, spanks the son, exiles the son to his room. Next day, the dad's at work, informed that he'll be promoted and get a raise. Arrives home, walks up the same sidewalk, trips over the same bicycle. This time, though, he gets up, brushes himself off, smiles, thinks to himself, boys will be boys, goes in the house, kisses his wife, pets the dog, and forgets it. That kind of inconsistency is bewildering to a child. The parents set standards, set punishments. The child breaks the standard once, nothing happens. The child breaks the standard again, and a storm of wrath falls upon his head. The child doesn't know where he or she stands, or if the parents are really serious. One day something's apparently permissible, the next day it is not. One day he is spanked for the offense, the next day he's not. Such a display of inconsistency may well drive a child to resentment and anger and giving up. How does he know what's going on? What's the use of trying to obey? Why are parents inconsistent? Perhaps number one is because of their own selfishness. Too busy with their own routines and schedules, doing what pleases them at the moment. It's annoying to have to stop and exercise a measured, thoughtful, systematic discipline. Convenience is really what determines the response. Impatience may explain the inconsistency. If they lay out a plan of discipline today and after 10 days they see no substantial improvement, they quit or at least begin to back off, they forget that real change takes a while, even in their own lives. And if they don't see the change instantly, well, they give up. The whole matter of inconsistency with standards. Here's another one. Too many rules. This one's kind of like living in our own government now, where quite possibly every one of us in here is a criminal under somebody's law. Nearly impossible to even know what they are. What's the federal code today? Tens of thousands of pages? How do you know? If you have dozens of rules and restrictions, you may think you're doing a fine job of discipline, but really that is seldom the case. Eventually, you'll turn into a kind of domestic detective in order to police all the rules, or you will fail to enforce many of them that you have made. Either way, it's bad. And the reaction of your sons and daughters may well be at length angry exasperation. Much healthier for you and your child to have a handful, 4 or 5 standards that are appropriate to the moment you're working in, father and mother studying their sons and daughters, identifying as a team where we are in the development of our sons and daughters, setting standards that have a keen relevance to the present time, explain those standards to the child, respond consistently when they're violated. And when a given standard has been internalized and become habitual in the life of the child, then you begin to turn your attention to something else. Not that you forget the one internalized, But then you begin to turn your attention to another standard, but always keeping those primary standards that are before the child to a minimum that can actually be enforced. Another matter that may well have the potential to break your child's spirit, to drive to angry exasperation, is divided authority. Husbands and wives not doing what I just described, who disagree over standards and responses when they're violated, who have never taken the time to reach agreement as a father-mother team beforehand. Instead, they wait until it's too late, the violation has occurred. One spouse may want to bring down fire and brimstone. The other thinks, Johnny, don't do that again, is enough. Or it may be that one spouse is convinced of the rightness of biblical discipline, the other is not. Singles, you need to make sure your prospective mate's on the same page. But if not, perpetually there is this marked difference in the rearing of that child. The child then is confused. Who should he listen to? Is it dad? Is it mom? Is he or she too hard? He or she too lenient? Who really cares about me? And again, there's only one solution to that divided authority, and that's regular, unified father-mother consultation. Studying your children. Identifying as a father-mother team. Their maturity level. The standards that have burning relevance at this moment. And getting to work on those. Teamwork. Ongoing mutual communication. Ongoing mutual assessment. Ongoing mutual evaluation between father, mother, having your standards arise from that kind of parental cooperation. That's the answer. This will surely result in angry exasperation. I think this is number 5 of what we could call a flaunted, abusive authority. Authority which is brandished with the arrogant attitude, I dare you to cross me. Authority without the undergirding of example, without the undergirding of fatherly and motherly love. Authority outside, if there's anything I could communicate here, that's outside the context of a well-rounded relationship with a child. And perhaps in the matter of corrective discipline, it's at that point that causes the discipline to be so effective. Because momentarily, there's a sense when a standard has been broken and a corrective response has to be rendered, that there's a fissure. There's a fracture in that relation. And if that relation to the child has been well-rounded and multifaceted, something like what I quoted last Lord's Day evening in this hour, there's a deterrent effect when that is lost. The kind of authority pictured when a father, as it were, puts on his domestic policeman badge and unsheathes his rod and goes marching through the house, bullying and barking his orders. If that's your way, first of all, you are miles away from biblically instructed corrective discipline. You're not even in the same universe. But you are in the universe of driving your children to an angry exasperation and giving up on you. Related, the matter of unjust punishment. Matthew Henry wrote this. Discipline, he's speaking of corrective discipline. Discipline is medicine. Matthew Henry, again. Discipline is medicine. But he who feeds his child with medicine as his normal fare will soon find that the medicine has no effect upon him and the child has no appetite for wholesome food. Unjust punishment or excessive punishment. Children are driven to anger when parents use a disciplinary sledgehammer to drive a thumbtack, metaphorically speaking. Correction should have a measure proportioned to the gravity of the offense. Unjust punishment can also occur when the child is falsely accused. Another possibility in answering the question, what are the behaviors on the part of father or mother that provoke a child to anger, exasperate a child such that the child loses heart? Well, here's one. And something of this has already been mentioned, I think, last Lord's Day. It's the failure. The failure to distinguish between what must be enforced as a rule and what a child must be allowed to learn on his own. To elaborate briefly, smothering that child, particularly if that child's a boy, with inordinate control and protectionism, hovering over that child, hovering around that child, not allowing that child freedom to learn, for fear that child is going to run a risk that may lead to injury. You do that at length. And if it's a boy, you get the kind of son, I hope you'd be ashamed to leave your house, the so-called mama's boy, who's scared of his shadow. Became that way because fathers and mothers, but fathers they're addressed, never had the wisdom to let the tether out incrementally so that that son would have to face adversarial relationships in this world, which are inevitable, and get out of his comfort zone and get into activities where, yes, he may fail. And granted, if you fed him with all this self-esteem nonsense, well, yeah, that may damage his delusion that he's the most important in the world. I've spoken earlier of distinguishing, and this is saying it in a different way, between swing issues and flame issues. Yes, when a child is running in the kitchen to touch that pretty little flame on the stove, you've got to intervene. But that same child at some point needs to learn, have the freedom to go out and swing in the backyard. Again, I'm not even sure they do that anymore, but that child must learn to ride a bicycle. and not necessarily be in full football gear. They may have a law here. You got to have a helmet to ride a bicycle. Maybe that's good sense. I'm sure it wasn't of growing up in the South. But you know, the matter, well, I personalize it this way. A son has to learn to catch a ball. Yes, he may catch it in the eye. But going out with his friends and having BB gun battles, he probably should not be allowed to do that. Swimming at the Y, I would say, is a swing issue. For a very young child running off unattended at a lake or a beach, that's a flame issue. Failure to distinguish between what must be enforced as a rule and what a child must be allowed to learn on his own if he's going to grow up, leave your home, and be an effective father or effective young man, young woman out in a world where adversity and risk and the prospect of failure are all over the place. You raise him in a cocoon, you're going to take the heart right out of him. You don't want to do that. And then another, we need to speed on here, another behavior that can take the heart out of a child is chronic criticism. Always emphasizing the negative. Unfavorably comparing that child to others who have superior gifts. And newsflash, God gives some one talent, some two, some five. Uniformity is not how he made the world. Teasing a child at the point of his weaknesses and immaturity, insulting the child with demeaning language, stupid, dumb, and worse, humiliating the child publicly, nagging and carping at the child. Wayne Mack, in a helpful book that I believe is cited in the bibliography, Wayne Mack writes, when speaking to your children, avoid using words like these. When will you ever? If your head weren't attached, you always, you never, you dummy, you clumsy ox, you slob, you knucklehead. As Wayne Mack writes, words such as these can be lethal weapons, leaving damaging scars in your children. If you've been accustomed to speaking to your children in this way, apologize and ask forgiveness and seek to reassure them that you do love and respect them. You're going to have to earn that back. But yes, reassure them. The matter of favoritism. And actually, we have some biblical narratives that would certainly infer this one. In Genesis 25, Jacob and Esau. Genesis 37, Jacob and his sons. The favoritism openly displayed towards Joseph. Favoritism, demonstrating partiality to other children in the family versus this child or that. Favoritism by means of time given, attention given, consistency of discipline given. The matter of discipline. Administered in a state of undisciplined anger. Perhaps that should go to the first top of the list. B.M. Palmer, in his marvelous book on the family, writes, and I quote, "Punishment should never be disciplined in anger for the simple reason that the principle upon which it turns is withdrawn alike from the view of the parent and child. It attests simply, that is the anger, to the power of the One, that is the Father, and fulfills no office of discipline to the other, that is the Son. You're just angry. You manifest, you have power over that child. The idea of correction has gone out the window. There was a clear distinction. Palmer writes, which no one is quicker than a child to perceive, between a cool, judicial displeasure. Now, I'm going to assume he's not talking that you go into the venue, the exercise of corrective discipline with a plastic smile on your face. There is a clear distinction which no one is quicker than a child to perceive between a cool judicial displeasure and the passion which wreaks its vengeance upon the helpless. Those latter words again point to something that is far removed from biblically informed corrective discipline. A vengeance. The passion which wreaks its vengeance upon the helpless. That's not discipline. Cool, in the words of Palmer, cool judicial displeasure is the climate for corporeal discipline. And finally, I'll just offer this. To having the potential to provoke a child to anger, to exasperate and take the heart out of a child. It's a child's awareness that you as father or mother, I never hear you admit your offenses. No model in your life of confession and repentance and seeking forgiveness. No example for that child to follow arising from circumstances. When you've been wrong, you've wronged that child. In your pride as a father with more power, you're not going to humble yourself before that child. I'd say that's almost certainly, if that's chronic, you're driving that child to an angry, exasperated attitude towards you. I'll quickly name a few others. Setting unrealistic standards for a child. Attempting to live out your unfulfilled aspirations through them when they don't have the gifts to carry them out. Robbing your children of physical and verbal expressions of love. Excuse me. And finally, physical abuse. Got this little tickle in my throat. Physical abuse. Well, I offer those as possibilities. And now you see a simple chart. What that is an effort simply to create consistency and system in the setting of standards for developing that are consistent with a developing child's maturity level, standards that are the product of the ongoing discernment of a father and mother, their consultations together, aimed at rearing a complete man or a complete woman over the years, versus an approach that is arbitrary, dependent on moods, dependent on the whims of the parents, that lead to a child's warped development, exasperation, a child being left to himself. Very simply, the behavior standards. What are the standards that have front burner relevance right now, that are commensurate with where the child is in his maturity and development? If you want to get some a lens to look through to identify those standards, look at those chief categories of character cultivation, the next to the last page. Go to the book of Proverbs and determine what are the elements of a given category and what is antithetical to a given category. That'll guide you to know what standards, consistent with real character development, are relevant. The middle column, the scriptural warrant to demonstrate you're not being arbitrary, capricious, that God's authority stands behind this. And then the consequence, whatever you think is appropriate. Well, I shouldn't say whatever, but is the rod appropriate for this? Or perhaps verbal correction in that circumstance? But this is the product of father and mother working together as a team. And this is dynamic. Again, as one standard is internalized, it comes off the chart, another goes on. The one that comes off is not forgotten. Hopefully by now, it's a part of the character of the child. Reevaluate, another one goes on. It's dynamic. I know that's a lot. It can seem daunting. It's a great promise that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us.